Well, hi everyone, welcome along to class this morning, and for those online, hello. We've come along to our last class on this CV module, and so today we'll be doing a review of a number of different questions, but we can begin as we normally do by doing a short breathing meditation. It will set up a visualization and remind ourselves of why we're engaged in these practices. In other words, we'll bring to mind our motivation. So let's begin as we normally do by engaging in a breathing meditation. So we start by getting comfortable in the seat. This basically ensures making sure your back is straight, your shoulders are relaxed. You can place your hands wherever you like and either keep your eyes open or close them. And as you continue to breathe normally and naturally, become aware of any movements or feelings felt in the body that will take place whenever you inhale or exhale. We're doing that to calm and stabilize the mind and to produce a relaxation response in the body. With the body relaxed and the mind calm and stable, imagine that in the space in front of you appears Shakyamuni Buddha, the entourage of the bodhisattvas, the arahats, and the protectors and so forth. Surrounding you are all sentient beings. I think that the bodhisattvas, the arahats, Shakyamuni Buddha, have all are abiding in a state of peace, having overcome all the disturbing emotions and their seeds and imprints, and that they are perfectly qualified and willing to help us. Where those who are surrounding us, all the sentient beings, are experiencing different forms of suffering. Some are experiencing the suffering of pain and mental distress. Others have their sense of happiness changing and disappearing. Whereas every one of them, us included, have a lack of control over the body and mind. This is called all-pervasive conditioning, the suffering of all-pervasive conditioning, the lack of control over the body and mind. And none of us wish to experience suffering, all of us want to be happy. And though this is our wish, what we do to be happy actually contributes to our suffering. And we want to put an end to that, those unskillful actions we engage in, so that we can actually accomplish our own welfare, have a stable sense of happiness, and be able to help others do the same. And if we can rely upon the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of us, upon their teachings, and upon them as a community, we can actually develop all of our good qualities and rid ourselves of every type of unskillful and negative quality. I think this is what you want to do. You want to sort of direct your life in that direction. The direction of putting an end to suffering and its causes and having all the good qualities. We'll take refuge in the Buddhas, in this community, and generate a mind of enlightenment. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become the Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So with this wish, from the heart of the Buddha, rays of light emanate. They wash over us and all the beings surrounding us. They remove the obstacles and empower us with an awakening of the good qualities. And we recite the four original thoughts. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. And the seven in prayer. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of the holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cycle of existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. So I think that by reciting that prayer, we dedicate this life to accumulating all the causes to bring about enlightenment and to purify our body, speech, and mind of anything that hinders our enlightenment. And now we come to making a mandala offering. So I think here that the essence of this is to let go of any clinging that we have to the body and to our ideas. In the absence of the clinging, this body transforms into a wonderful pure land whereby we can give teachings and others can take teachings. I think this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, the dog without merely four contents of ceremony, I imagine this Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. So we release the offering and we see that it's accepted by the Buddha, who smiles at us with delight. So we take a moment now to look into the Buddha's eyes and notice that smile. And the refuge field surrounding the Buddha begins to dissolve into light. So the body sattvas and the other Buddhas, the arahats and so forth, dissolve into light, melt into the central figure of Shakyamuni Buddha. From the heart of a Buddha, an emanation of light moves through space, comes to the vine above the crown of your head, descends, entering the crown of your head, coming down to rest at the level of your heart. The radiant body of the Buddha begins to expand, filling your body and mind with light. And the light goes out through the pores of your skin, filling all of space. And wherever there are beings within that space, they have been touched by that light and completely transformed into fully awakened beings. The idea of self and other and inner and outer have vanished. Because there's no difference between the deeper stature of one's own mind and the mind of any enlightened being. I think that from the furthest direction of space, when the light begins to withdraw, re-entering your heart. Acknowledge that you have a potential to be too fully awakened and bring about your deepest desires and the ability to help others effortlessly. but to actually bring that ability to fruition, we need to study the methods and then put the methods into practice so that we can become fully awakened and bring about the benefit of others. And with this motivation for being in these classes, breathe in deeply through your nostrils, then exhale through the mouth, and then allow your eyes to flutter open, and move your limbs and make yourself comfortable in your seat. So we've gone through 8 classes in this module, and today we're going to be doing the review class. So basically we have studied the causes for taking refuge, and we'll go through this again. We've also looked at these 3 rare sublime ones, more commonly known as the 3 jewels, or Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Now, there are many benefits for taking refuge. A couple of them being that you accomplish everything you wish for, you actually become a Buddhist, you can actually become a Buddha. And on the way from being a Buddhist to a Buddha, you can have particular vows that you can actually use to help you accomplish your purpose. And a lot of this is all explained in a ceremony called the Refuge Ceremony, which we're having in a couple of weeks' time. And in that class, we talked about many of the different vows that you are introduced to and that you accept. Now, today, we're going to be looking at, first of all, answering 12 questions, what they call a small group discussion. And there's another section there called 4 questions of the sample system. So all of these will answer in this teaching today. So if anybody wants to do this review, you know what to do. So I've relied upon these particular texts. They haven't changed at all, but I also looked at another text last night. I went back to a text called The Jeweled Staircase by Geshe Wangyal. It's a little bit... its tone is like a science manual, so it's not so easy to read, or it's quite dry, yet it's very deep, and so and it really gets straight to the point, so it's quite a good thing too. So I relied on some of that material for this particular class. Now, Lama Yeshe said that Westerners should understand that refuge is a state of mind. Going for refuge or taking refuge is basically a state of mind. And in relationship to that, Geshe Wangyal says, it's not enough to just recite the refuge prayer. We must find out the actual meaning of refuge. But going for refuge is a mental state composed of either wisdom or a virtuous attitude, such as faith, effort, or mindfulness. So remember one of the classes I've put out to you, how you can become a Buddhist. If you do it through wisdom, it's through the 4
seals.
Right? We know, we adopt the attitude through investigation that all products are impermanent, that all contaminated phenomena are unsatisfactory. They're all phenomena lack sun, and that nirvana is peace. If we took that on, that's the wisdom aspect. The other side is what we have more faith, effort, and mindfulness is the way we've been presented in the class. In other words, we know what these objects are, we know how to distinguish each from one another. We know how to take refuge in them, and we've decided that once we have done, we'll never forsake them. But going for refuge means that one understands the qualifications and classifications of the 3 rare sublime ones and confidently makes a commitment to them such that one does not call on others for a final refuge. A mental state composed of either wisdom or a virtuous attitude. Now, before we take refuge in the 3 rare sublime ones, we take refuge in other objects. because what's always driving us is wish to be happy, wish to experience less fear and less suffering. And those objects that we've taken refuge in began with our mother. And then they went across to your dad, the rest of the family. Later on, when you get married or you have a partner, you'll rely a lot upon them. And for those who find great difficulties having human partners, it depends.
Yeah, well, often your first pet too when you're a kid is such an important relationship.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, lovely thing about pets is we know they just basically love you, right? They never answer back. And they're not really, they don't get resentful towards you. They just accept you. And so I think we really appreciate that. And so we place a lot of our hopes and confidences and our fears in those pets, and they hold them. Other things we could take refuge in, nationalists, for instance, often take refuge in their country. Others will take refuge in their home. Home is the hearth, the place you always go to and feel safe, or even their society. Many of us today take refuge in entertainment. If we want to feel good, we go and see a show or we put some music on. Or else we get involved in other aspects of the culture. Other objects of refuge, of course, are doctors whenever we find ourselves ill, exercise regimes to keep ourselves healthy, and other health professionals. Another real common refuge is food. Alcohol, sex and drugs, religion and philosophy. Many of us take refuge in the job that we have. And if you don't have a job, or if you do have a job and you come home, what to do? You get involved in a hobby. Now, people place a lot of attention and time in a hobby. I remember here all the time, what we're trying to do is just to be happy, but decrease our suffering in some way. So others do that by entering the politics and seeking power. And another very, very common form of refuge is wealth, seeking money. So these are the common refuges, and then the refuge, we'll find that we've taken refuge in these objects. And you'll see that nearly all of them are outer objects. And again, what we're trying to do is to avoid suffering in some way, avoid anxieties and so forth, and just be happier, more content people. And then basically you can sum all these up into what they call worldly concerns. And they can always sum up into what they call the eight worldly concerns. Now, it's quite interesting, this term, when they use the word worldly. So we might think of it as just like in relationships to the world, but in fact, it doesn't mean that. It means unstable. Now, I know that when we take refuge in these objects, we just look at, you don't think of them as being unstable. You think they're going to be stable. They're actually going to provide us with a stable happiness. And all of them can be placed into these four categories. And the first one is what they call pleasure and pain. We wish to experience comfort, nice things, and avoid discomfort and the unpleasant things. So for the sake of pleasure, you know, we have to earn a living. If you're a farmer, you need to cultivate the land and so forth. If you're involved in business, you have to build up the business and so on. And all of these are to avoid, like, being poor, you know, a lack of money, a home, all those sort of things. Other things, of course, that we see in terms of wealth and having things, possessions. So we try to gain as much as we possibly can, thinking this will make me happy, this will keep me happy and content, and try to avoid losses. When we get these things, we often don't want to lose them. And we experience suffering when they deteriorate or we do lose them. Something else we can place our idea of taking refuge in is to be thought of as a very good person, to have the approval of others, and wish to avoid being blamed, being criticised and being abused. We find those things very difficult to deal with, and we don't want them.
especially like online when there's a huge explosion of criticism and abuse, and it's so
prevalent, common.
So common and so, you know, destroying for those people.
Yeah. And so you can find, isn't it, like you can be praised on one side and you get put up and then you get knocked down. In Australia, New Zealand, the tall poppy syndrome. Mm-hmm. If you seem to be successful in something, huge backlash comes. Yeah. So we don't want the backlash. We just want the tall poppies. Mm-hmm. And finally, as I said, you know, success. We all like to be successful. With the media now, you see a lot of people saying, I just want to be famous. And they don't know the bad side, the flip side of that. Thinking just being famous will do it for me. And I think that, you know, the wish to avoid failure and becoming insignificant. So these concerns, these things that we wish, you know, to seek delight, to seek pleasure, on one side the positive, one side the negative, one we want, one we wish to avoid. Now, we did a class a few years ago just on this. Actually, it was about maybe 2 months or something, wasn't it? 2 to 3 months. We just went through all of these in the library, a small group of us. And one of the things I asked the class to do was to look at it like on the right side, where we seek delight, to find what was really problematic about having your wishes game, right? So the sense of comfort. What's the problem with having comfort? What's the problem with having all the nice things? So we talked about that for about a couple of months. You know, on the other side was, and what is really good about being uncomfortable? What's really great about meeting up with the unpleasant? So we sort of reversed it. And that way you can see, like, this idea of thinking, oh, only on one side it's really good and the other side it's really bad, that's just not true.
Well, straight away, it just confounded me how anyone could think fame is a good thing. You know, there's so many obvious drawbacks of fame.
And then you can see there's so many advantages of being insignificant.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we sort of do that. So there's not so, while we did that, so there wasn't so much attachment and grasping on the seeking delight side, and much less aversion and so forth on the avoiding displeasure side. And what that does, it produces a sense of equanimity between the two. And also, it's not so, you don't get such a bias toward one and the other.
And don't freak out as much either when things continue to change.
Yeah. So it's on the side of the comfort, the nice things. One of the things that you could think of is that to have comfort and nice things requires a lot of work, usually. So there's this thing, do you want to do all that work to have those nice things, that comfort?
I remember one of our students who was so excited about getting a boat. And he got the boat, and then, like, within 2 weeks, was like, oh my God, the amount of work you've got to put into the boat, and then this and the that, and then every weekend I've got to do something to it. Became this real drag, and he got the boat so he could see the fireworks on New Year's Eve by the Story Bridge. And he was so sick of it that he sold it in November, and he wouldn't get there.
Well, when I was much younger, I had a formed a friendship with these two other guys, and we bought a yacht. We had this idea, you know? And I was thinking, before we got it, I was just thinking, none of us know how to sail. Like, we're going to have to put all this effort into becoming sailors. Then we're going to have to out. And I was thinking, like, you know, so we looked at the result, thinking it's going to be so great, but then the process is not so great. And then this is the point, you could go there, it could sink. You know, all these terrible things can happen to that on the ocean. You know, it cost me a great deal of money and it taught me a great deal. Yeah. So, and on the other side, you know, is so in other words, so, you know, we need to sort of reverse our thinking. So instead of thinking, oh, it'd be so wonderful to have comfort and so forth, you look, what are the pitfalls here? So, well, I've got to do a lot of effort, has to be put into being comfortable. And on the side of the pain side, how can I think of pain in a more discomfort or the unpleasant things in a really meaningful and useful way? And so one of the ways that you can think about it is, as His Holiness has said, as Shantideva has said, if I can do something about this pain, then I will. There's no need to feel, to have bad thoughts about it. And if I can't do anything else, if I can't do anything about it at all, well, worry and complaint won't help me. Anyway, you know, the idea of looking at this material is there's nothing wrong with pleasure. It's just that we sort of become a little bit extreme about it, thinking just having pleasurable events will really make me happy.
And relying on them, because then when they change, so Martin's pointed out, all these things can change in an instant.
Yep.
When they change, we're continuously shocked and surprised and upset about that.
Yeah. That's right. And so this is where this term worldly comes in. They're unstable. And yet oftentimes you don't see that instability when you first glance. But so what this is pointing out is that these objects will not provide you with certain happiness, certain and stable happiness. So they're not reliable as forms of refuge. Now, I guess it's we seek these objects of refuge at a deep level where we're just trying to be happy. We're trying to avoid anxiety, distress, anything on the opposite side, stuff that makes us unhappy. Now, when we see that that doesn't work in terms of the eight worldly concerns, we still have this desire to be happy. So when we come to seek refuge as a Buddhist, and we do so because it's the same thing we have, an alarm or a dread at the different forms of suffering that we experience. And we wish to find some way of freeing ourselves from that. So reasons for seeking refuge as a Buddhist, we have an awareness of some form of danger. The danger is the danger of suffering. We have to have a faith or a conviction that we can actually avoid those sufferings. And if we are Buddhists who are practicing in the Mahayana, we need to bring into it compassion. And basically, if you think about it, we are bringing in compassion for ourselves when we're aware of a danger and wish to prevent that. So there's a fear or alarm or dread of some form of suffering that we could experience. And in the Mahayana Dharma, the fear or dread or alarm that you have is about the suffering you could experience after your death. And a confidence or a trust that you won't experience that suffering. You can avoid it. And because it's the Mahayana refuge, it becomes the objects are bigger than ourselves. It's ourself and everyone else. Now, you often hear the word fear used, and many times people don't like to hear that word fear. They think fear is all negative, and we shouldn't feel fear. But if there is something that is legitimately frightening, you should be afraid. And you want to be afraid so you will do something to avoid it. And if you can find something that will genuinely separate yourself from that danger, then you should do that. You should have confidence in that.
So actually, fear keeps us safe.
Yeah, of course.
If
it's legitimate.
If it's legitimate. And I'm just thinking, like, you know, teenage boys that have all testosterone and no fear and all the risky behaviour.
That's right. Break their necks jumping into pools that they don't realise are very shallow, or get killed in accidents, or in hotels and drinking and arguing and getting hit and fighting, you know, all those sort of things. If you're not aware of those dangers, that's what can happen to you. You can die very young. In the Buddha Dhamma, you know, we seek this refuge as we know that the eight worldly concerns are not providing us with the refuge we seek. Right? So I said, well, that ain't working. It's not working that I've got a house and a wonderful wife and four kids. Right? I'm still, for some reason, not satisfied. I'm unhappy. What's going on here? So we've got to sort of look at all that and think there's something else I'm missing. So we look at that, and then so all the way up to death, and if you're a reasonable person, you'd think, you know, like I'm going to die, what's it all for?
So Susan's asking, is fear of ending up in the lower realms, for instance, is that like the ultimate fear?
No, it's not the ultimate fear. It's one of the fears. It's the first level of fear that we need to generate to actually take refuge. Oh, the fear is even greater. And we'll introduce them to you now in the next slide, right? So we talk about these greater fears or lesser fears. We're talking about the capacity of the person to be able to bear different types of fear. And not only bear the fear, but have a method to avoid that danger. So we give the person a small scope. So we'd say, hey, this is the person who may not be a Buddhist, but then who's even is a Buddhist. But they're beginning their path. They can see that the worldly refuges are not working for them. So they decide that there's got to be some other way. Then they might come along to Buddhism and go, this suits me. So what do I need to do? What am I trying to avoid? And what's going to help me do that? So here in the small scope, what we're trying to avoid is a bad rebirth that will take place after death. So we all know, we're all going to die. We're introduced to the concept that mind continues. That we don't just die and it's all over. That something else will happen. And that something else could be terrible. And we want to avoid that. So to avoid the sufferings of the lower realms, we need to be like ethical people. We engage in a practice of ethics, and the simple practices avoid the 10 harmful behaviors, the body, speech, and mind, and engage in the positive ones. Decrease your desires for the eight worldly concerns. If you do this, you will have a good rebirth and have forms of happiness in cyclic existence. Now, the next level up, the person, if you think that through, you'll go, okay, so well, great, so I avoid these, you know, great dangers of the lower realms. I can be reborn once again as a human being. But hang on a minute, like I'm already a human being, I've thought this through and I've got all these sufferings that I've tried to avoid. This just means I'm going to have it all over again. And you go, yeah, it does. So, what's it going here? Does that make a lot of sense to you? And you'd go, well, you might think, well, no. So, what's the point of having this human rebirth again? So, to keep on engaging in the path, because you could actually bring about a sense of complete freedom. You could stop that process. Which leads us to the second type of person, who is of middling capacity or middling scope. So, their goal is they see that human beings suffer, and they want to put an end to the suffering altogether that is coming about through the process of rebirth, being reborn as a human being. So they seek liberation from cyclic existence altogether. Now, to do that, they need to engage in what they call the three higher trainings of morality, concentration, and wisdom, a particular wisdom that realizes emptiness. And that will put an end to uncontrolled rebirth within cyclic existence. And this person accomplishes their own welfare. But with a little bit of thinking, I mean, not much either. It was like when I first introduced this concept to my brother, the first thing he thought was, what about everyone else? And that's all we think. What about my mum? What about my dad, my brothers, my sisters, my partner, my pets? I get out and they say, can anything be done about that? And the answer is yes. So that introduces the concept of the person of great scope. Now they too seek freedom from the sufferings of cyclic existence, but they're not doing it just for themselves, they're doing it for everyone else. And what they fear here is the solitary peace of nirvana that the person in the middle scope has achieved. But they have two fears. And the way to overcome these two fears and what they need to practice is the six perfections and the practices of tantra.
So what's the second fear again? The first fear is the small scope of the lower realms. The second fear is
the suffering of cyclic existence.
For everyone.
They're for themselves. And the great scope, we have the fear of sufferings of cyclic existence and fear of being achieving the solitary peace that the other person had. You don't want either of those. So we call this, they're trying to achieve a non-abiding nirvana. They don't abide in the cyclic existence, but they don't abide in the solitary peace of nirvana either. So to do that, we have to study quite a bit. In order to find out about the two truths, first of all, meaning like how things exist, then the four truths, and then it depends upon the four truths. This shows you how you can actually take refuge in the three jewels and bring about the goal we seek. That's how it's really structured. So as Holiness says, by beginning with the topics of the two truths, the four truths, which introduce us to the concepts of emptiness and dependent arising, we gain an initial understanding that forms a good foundation for taking refuge in the three jewels. Based on taking refuge, we then learn, contemplate, and meditate on the Buddha's teachings, and the understanding we gain from that deepens our refuge. That deeper refuge will inspire us to learn, contemplate, and meditate even more, bringing even deeper understanding, and so it goes. Taking refuge and understanding how the teachings relate to that until you achieve your goal. Now, of course, if you take refuge with this sort of background and with this understanding of what you're trying to avoid and knowing that you can avoid what you fear, I mean, this will definitely change your life. So how? Is the question. How does refuge change ordinary life? So for me, like the first thing that was for me was a sense of relief. My question as a young person going up for a long, long time is, what am I doing here? What's the point? Now, what is the point of being a human being? And what am I to do as a human being? So as a person who always wondered about this, I didn't know the answer. I'm wondering. So what can I do? Well, I looked around to see what were all the other human beings doing. And I couldn't agree with the point of it. What were they doing? I don't get it. And so for a long time, my life was like that. I'm really 40, actually. Still didn't know. Like, I remember once in my mid-20s, finding myself in jail and thinking, God, I hope I know what the point is by the time I'm 30. And then when I was 30, I found myself in jail again and thought, haven't worked it out. Then when I was 40, I found myself in jail for life. And I was there going, I've got to work this out. It's okay, I can work it out now. I can't mess around. And I think just having that idea and really being determined to find out, some very good things happened to me. So I never ended up doing that life in jail, and here I find myself now in front of a Buddhist class. So it was a great relief for me to know the purpose of life as a human being. And I actually remember reading the sentence. It was in a book by Lama Zopa Rinpoche. He said, "The purpose of your life is to help others." I really fell off my chair. It's so obvious. So that was a massive relief. I was going, of course, of course. So thinking back and going, yeah, when I was much younger, I wanted to do that. I wanted to join the Salvation Army to help everyone. But I couldn't get my head around God. I thought, I just can't do that with that type of belief. It's, you know, it's an impossibility. So I just sort of give it up. I thought, I don't know what to do, and I don't know what the purpose is, and blah, blah, blah. So one of the great things that I said, once you know that you have a sense of relief, you know what not to do. You can stop doing all the things that didn't work and adopt all the things that do.
That's a really big thing, knowing what to do, what's right, sure, and what's wrong, because you just don't want to take it because someone else says so. You don't actually have a conviction in it.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily obvious.
No, and you have to have a goal. You know, it's only depends upon the goal, isn't it? You know, like these things will get me closer to it, and these things won't. So all the things that won't get me, I'm not doing them, but the things that do, I'm going to do them. And what that brings about is a taming of the mind. So the taming of the mind is really to do with this, I won't do this, and I will do this. I know what to adopt, I'll do those things. I'll know what does not work, and I won't adopt those things. So that way you tame your mind. So we, you know, like we go for refuge. We take refuge in this. And by taking refuge, we are trusting an institution, a method, or a person who can help you through crisis or difficulty to deliver you to a more favorable outcome. Now, Kensa Rinpoche said a wonderful thing that I've never forgotten. He said, when you go for refuge, it's really important to avoid the wrong attitude of thinking that now that you've gone for refuge, you don't need to do anything else. But so like this is the end point. In fact, it's the beginning point. It's actually the beginning. The wonderful thing about it is, it's a really good beginning. Like now you know. Right? Before you made, like I did, all sorts of mistakes, trying to work it out. You didn't know. I didn't know. But once you know, you begin. Now you can begin with much greater certainty. And when we take refuge, this step of first taking refuge is called causal refuge. So what does that mean, causal refuge? It means that you're taking refuge in outer objects. So the outer object you take refuge in is what was the teacher called Buddha. And so I remember when I first read about the Buddha, I read a book, what's it called? Siddhartha, by Hermann Hesse. And I remember reading that and going, wow, somebody cracked it. But somebody's done it. And what I meant by that was like, well, somebody's put an end to suffering. So there's like, okay, well, wow, it can be done. So the next question is, what did he do to do that? Which leads us to what we call the Buddhist scripture, the teachings themselves. So when you first come across these teachings, you'll come across like this. Someone's talking to you or you read a book. So that's outer Dharma. But we have to make it ours, because that's the only way you can bring about the result or something. Right? So just listening and reading won't do it. You have to bring it inward. You have to, what they call the Dharma of Realization, which of course is basically the true paths, true cessations, and as many virtuous thoughts and minds as you can bring to your life. independent, rely on others who are in the process of doing that. And this is what we call the Sangha. The other people who have taken refuge in the three rare supplements, committed their lives to it. And so that's what we do, isn't it? We find the people who've got robes and we ask them sort of questions. We think, well, these people have thought through a bit further than I have. They've actually committed their lives to this. And oftentimes we'll talk to the Geshe, the Lama, the teacher, because we don't know. Maybe our reading, we haven't read as much, or we have questions about what we've read and so forth. So we need something external to us to help us have confidence in it. And think, well, they can, they're human, so just like me at one stage, but they're much further than I am at another. These are people I can rely on to talk to. And this is what they mean by causal refuge. So what you've sort of done is you've made a pledge, and call the refuge pledge, and this is to accept the Buddha, the teacher, the teachings and the community as the safest direction to go to free yourself from the sufferings and the obscurations that you experience. So you find yourself, I'm doing that a lot, I'm sure, you know, you just don't know what to do. These people, you think, well, they probably know more what to do than my psychologist or psychiatrist or the neighbor. And so taking this refuge, it is the foundation and entrance to all the Buddhist practice. And when we become the authentic refugees by taking this pledge, remember we've taken this because there are certain things we fear. We don't want to happen to us. Like, for instance, we don't want more suffering to take place in our lives. But if it does, it's like we have to be like, what's causing it? You know, so here we look at, unlike most other people, that the causes of our suffering are not coming from out there. That's the major thing. I mean, everyone thinks what causes suffering, the primary causes are out there in the world. They're coming at us. Buddhism says, no, the primary cause is mind. Undisciplined, unknowing mind. Yeah, so one of the things when I got this very, when I got my life sentence, you know, so I really wanted thinking about why am I here? And my answer to myself was, you don't know how to think. So poor thinking got me in jail. And what we call poor thinking, or not knowing how to think, is in Buddhism called ignorance. And that is the primary cause for suffering. And this ignorance has got two aspects. One is just not knowing, but the other is thinking that you know something is true, when in fact it's not. So one of the things I thought would be true would be if I had a lot of money, I might be happy. So once you realize all that doesn't work, and now you've taken refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, you sort of go, you know, this is the steer me in a safe direction, in the direction where actually my wishes will be accomplished. So then we ask them, well, what's Buddha? What's Dharma? And what is Sangha? So when we ask that sort of question, we want to know what they are. In other words, we're trying to define them. And of course, there are different ways of this defining. So in the Pali tradition, in the tradition of the elders, the Buddha is a historic person. So they have this faith, in the authenticity of an historical person who achieved the state of becoming a Buddha. In the Mahayana, it's a bit different. And the way they do it is like this. A Buddha jewel is an ultimate object of refuge, which has eight excellent qualities, such as uncreated and so forth. And so I think one of the questions in this review is, what's the quality of the Buddha? And you should say, uncreated. And this is how Buddha is defined, the Buddha jewel. And if they ask you, like, what's an example of the Buddha jewel? You'd say, Shakyamuni Buddha. To know how to go for refuge, you have to know these qualities of the refuge objects, like Buddha. So he's got one of the qualities is uncreated. You see, that's right. He's uncreated, right? We know what distinguishes the Buddha from any other being. And when we know all this, how have we committed ourselves to taking refuge in the Buddha? What does that mean? So, between each of the three jewels. So the distinction here, of course, is the Buddha teaches the Dharma. And then if you look at the Dharma, what distinguishes that from the other objects and also from other things is true paths and true cessations.
Would it also be that the Dharma is the actual refuge?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And then, you know, how to commit ourselves to this refuge object and refusing to commit ourselves to other objects for our refuge, our ultimate refuge. So Geshe Wangyal, again from the Dual Staircase on page 90, says, this fourfold way of going for refuge includes understanding the classifications of the three rare sublime ones, understanding their qualifications, committing ourselves to them, and not calling on others for refuge. And so that's how we go for refuge. So the last two bits are probably the easiest, isn't it? Committing ourselves to them. And we only do that because we know their good qualities and we know how to distinguish them one from another, what they're capable of doing. Once we know that, we commit ourselves to it and we disavow other objects, other refuge objects being a supreme refuge. So when we take refuge in the Buddha, we do so because we have this, it's because the Buddha possesses four types of self-confidence. The Buddha, first of all, is free from all fears of suffering. He's skilled in the method of delivering others from their fear. Thirdly, he's impartial to everyone. His compassion extends to any living being. And lastly, pleased by practice, he's engaged in work for the welfare of all, whether others are helpful or harmful to him.
So that's the four qualities of a valid refuge. Yep. So valid meaning that we have confidence, that's how come we can have confidence in the refuge.
Yeah, that's right. And it's often said also, this topic is very large, the one on the Buddha, right? So you can look at it through looking at the Buddha's qualities of body, speech, mind, qualities and power. And that's another way of looking at it. But what I've done here is sort of summed up in this next slide the six ways of looking at a Buddha and going, okay, this is if I could just get this in my head, I can answer these questions. So what distinguishes the Buddha, for instance, from any other teacher? Well, he's fully enlightened. If you look back the other one, he's free from all fears of suffering. He's overcome all his own fears and become fully enlightened. So that's a distinguishing characteristic from any other teacher, being fully enlightened. What's he do? What's his activity? He gives the teachings. In terms of our relationship to this, to the Buddha jewel, we make offerings of service by listening to these teachings and trying to put them into practice and acting in ways that are harmonious with his instruction. We emulate him. We recollect him by almost like thus the Bhagavan is that. The Buddha did this. This is what this term means. The Buddha did this. So you see in the Heart Sutra, at one time, the Blessed One, the da da da, that's the Bhagavan. So Buddha gave a teaching. You see this in heaps and heaps of sutras. So what's saying is we are recollecting the teaching that he gave, his activity. And we've got to emulate that as best we possibly can. Now, in terms of a field of merit, it's indirect and direct. So what's being sort of said here is, we look at merit here, it's what's empowering our mind, what gives the mind the energy to keep on engaging in our refuge. And so how we're experiencing it can be coming in these two ways, directly or indirectly. If it was directly, you're going to get a big shock. And you never lose your refuge. Indirectly, you can say it's coming from every other teacher that you meet. But because they're all expressing the words of the Bible.
Oh, okay.
You take that on, your mind changes.
Right. Whereas if we actually saw a Buddha walk in the room, then we wouldn't fall off our chair.
That's right. Not the kind of species for the world. So this is the simplest way, as I've set it up in the labyrinth chamber. Now, you know, so now we come to this idea of committing ourselves and the refusal. We commit ourselves in this way. We accept the Buddha as the ideal teacher of refuge. So refuge is a safe direction to take. And we refuse other teachers or systems as an alternate refuge, alternate direction. Our direction here and the process of it is to put an end to suffering and develop all good qualities and help others do the same. That's our direction. That's the direction we're going in and our goal. And we refuse other directions. When we come to the Dharma drill, is defined again. This has some qualities mentioned. So it's the truth of complete purification in the continuum of an Arya. This is endowed with any of the eight qualities, such as inconceivable.
Right, so the Buddha was uncreated and the Dharma inconceivable.
So what that basically means, they're like, in other words, no matter how you think of it, it's like it's inexpressible. Inconceivable, inexpressible. It's really very, very hard to say what it actually is. Because remember that what it actually is it's an absence, the Dharma's absences of anything that hindered you before. It's very hard to talk about absence, isn't it? Something that's not there.
There's that Christian hymn, so high, I can't get over it, so low, I can't get over it.
Yeah, that's right, like that. That's
the word of the Lord.
There it is, inconceivable. Yeah. And again, you know, the Dharma jewel, what's its characteristic? It's the result of the Buddha's enlightenment. And sometimes we say it also produces the Buddha's enlightenment and it's the result of it. The activities are set to abandon suffering and its causes. And to do that, you actually have to realize the paths that bring about those cessations. How we do that? You actually practice it. You have to practice.
So that's different from just learning it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You have to learn, and then you have to do.
To actualize
it. Yeah, that's right. You've got to actually become it. Yeah. Yeah, so in other words, it's like, you know, some of them talk about nirvana, it's called peace. But these true cessations are actually states of peace. So in other words, you know, you bring about the cessation of anger, so you no longer have anger. So you are the person who has brought an end to your own anger. But like that's shown, right? You know, we have to actualize it. Be the person without anger. And this, of course, it brings good results. And the merit, of course, really affects our own mind strength.
Is that also because the Dharma doesn't just exist out there in a vacuum? The Dharma has to exist in the mind stream of
a being.
Of a being. Mm-hmm. Not in the book.
No, it's not in the book. Now, definition of Sangajo. So here it's an Arya person. Arya meaning somebody who's attained the path of seeing. An Arya person possessing in their mind stream any of the eight qualities of knowledge and liberation. If you look at the qualities, you could go knowledge and liberation. So this is, you know, the symbolic representation of the Sangha jewel is a group of four or more fully ordained monks or nuns who have received the ethical restraints set forth by the Buddha. And then we have the Sangha jewel. Their distinctive characteristic is to practice correctly through personal instruction. Their activity is to take joy in practicing the teachings. In terms of devotion, to be in harmony with the teachings and to practice correctly. And in terms of practices, to foster enthusiasm.
For themselves or for others?
They are to be enthusiastic in what they're doing, and we, seeing their enthusiasm, wish to practice and be with them and learn about the Buddha teachings. Yes, imagine if people have come across an ordained person who had no enthusiasm for what they were doing. Wouldn't be too promising for us, would it? No. Yeah, in terms of their recollection, they recollect that they are the support of all the good qualities that come about through engaging in the Dharma tool. So in other words, they're developing all of these good qualities, and we, who are relying upon them, see that they are doing so, seeing that they are good people. And in terms of merit, we make more merit in offering to the Sangha jewel than ever the Dharma jewel or the Buddha jewel. But in terms of the Buddha jewel, it's like, you know, if we think of the statues, no, they're not. If we saw our teacher as being the Buddha jewel, well, that's a bit different, isn't it? But there's a jewel, your guru is the Sangha jewel, isn't he? Yeah, he's one of the Sangha jewel. That's how we make, this is also like the causal stages of reference, right? Taking reference in these other objects that have these qualities and we can discern the differences between them and so forth. But when we take refuge, we're taking refuge in two types of object. One is the causal, which we've just spoken about, and the other is the resultant. And the resultant has to do with us as the practitioner. So let's look at that now. So here, what I've done here is put it into two ways, but I've only put on the side one way. So when we take refuge in the resultant state of the Buddha, in other words, we're saying, Buddha is me. I am going to become Buddha. What's going to make that possible? How is that actually possible? By relying on that outer three jewels? And Buddha nature. If you don't have the Buddha nature, no matter how much you rely on them, you'd never become a Buddha. We've got the Buddha nature. Yeah? Emptiness of the mind. All objects are empty. We have a mind that is empty. This is our potential for actually waking up. And so let's, notice I've put here, this is the cause. Well, if you engage in the outer three jewels, you produce the result, which is Buddhahood for ourselves. Now, of course, you know, we have this Buddha has got these, what they call four bodies. So the Dharma here is in the causal state is the true paths and true cessations, which actually produces those. So the Buddha has these true cessations, doesn't it? He's also got the true powers that produce them. So here we have, like, I think it's called the nature body of the Buddha, like the true cessations. And the mind itself. So that's us also.
So this is the resultant?
Yeah, that's right. This is the result. So like I said, here I've put up it's called resulter, but I've actually tried to get you to see that actually you've got all the causes. You have the causes.
And it brings the result.
And it brings the result. Okay. And up here, I put on the slide basically the causes. And the sun is all the good qualities. So what good qualities? Well, we have good qualities right now. All I've got to do is to be developed fully.
And we have to take refuge in our good qualities right now anyway.
That's right. And you know, they provide a refuge for us. Our good qualities, our every virtuous mental state is a refuge for us. So we have these already, but they're not perfected. They're mainly about us, aren't they?
It's like then you were saying about having patience before at the PNC meeting, you know, so that's really taking refuge in your own good quality of patience.
Yeah.
And if you didn't have that, then doesn't matter what you believe in.
So in terms of the result of the refuge, we talk about the four bodies. Right? So in here, this, what's called the Sangha is what they call Nirmanakaya and Sambhavakaya. The two paths through cessation, this is really nature body. Buddha is Dharmakaya. Dharmakaya. So it's Dharmakaya, nature body, Sangha, Nirmanakaya, and Sambhavakaya. So we become the refuge object for all beings. Well, you know, like I said, I want to put causes here. So for me, it's like you have more confidence. You look at the other, just the result, it might seem like, well, that's a bit beyond me, but I want to say, no, it's not. You know, like true paths and true cessation. So we might not have true cessations because they haven't been developed through true paths. But there are types of behaviors we won't do. We have stopped ourselves from doing them. And so we can already see, it's possible. So as you can see, hopefully, there's a lot of benefits in being an authentic Buddhist refugee. So there are some of them, of course. One, you are a Buddhist. Now, there's another lovely way of thinking about this term Buddhist, meaning insider. Right, so what that means is you are inside the fold of the Buddhist teachings. Now, as you know about the Buddhist teachings, they're really about mental development. So mental is not out there, it's in here, it's the inside. So in other words, you're dedicating yourself, affirming to yourself that you will develop your inner qualities. You will not rely so much on the outer world of the senses to provide you with the happiness you're seeking. But because we know the object of the senses can just as easily produce suffering for us. If we keep doing that, we're not Buddhists, just ordinary person. And of course, as a Buddhist, if we wish to seek enlightenment itself, which we should be, this will depend upon different practices. And when we engage in those practices, there are vows given with them, ways to engage in the practice that will hold you up, get you closer to your goal. So you become what they call a vow holder. Like if you study enough, you'll see Mahayana is the way to go. You'll see that the Mahayana is broken up into two parts. One is sutra method, one's a tantra method. Sutra method is very long, take a great deal of time to do it. With more study, you'll see that actually it's possible to accomplish it in a shorter period of time. So we should think it's a shorter period of time. That's great for me. It's great for others that you can do it in a shorter period of time. The longer it takes you, the longer people suffer. So it's because you want to put it into their suffering as soon as possible, you go, okay, I'm going to engage in the temporal path. So to do that, once again, you make these promises. that you do your very best to keep. And when you find that you don't keep them as well as you can do, you reaffirm the vow and you keep on going. By doing this, you can eliminate old habit patterns and the suffering that those habit patterns produce. By doing so, you accumulate, like I said, a vast deal of energy. No miserable realms for you. You're not thwarted in what you seek to achieve. So this is where you find it really interesting and fantastic. So ordinary people who don't know about the Buddha Dharma, who don't know about emptiness and dependent origination, who don't know the techniques of thought transformation, when difficulties arise for them, they see them as difficulties. They approach them as difficulties. Buddha Dharma, that does not have to be the case. And in fact, if you're smart enough and familiar enough with the teachings, everything is an advantage to you. There is no actual hindrance to you. Everything is workable and helpful. It's very cool. Like I said, it's actually says that you will not be thwarted by humans or non-humans. But so how's that going to happen? Well, that really depends upon how you want to develop your mind and your relationship to the objects.
One of the biggest difficulties people have is, say, family commitments that keep you away from the Dharma, as if family and Dharma are separate.
Yep, that's right. You see, no, in fact, everything is workable. In fact, on Sunday, Geshe Sopa gave this great teaching. It was only like, when I looked at the text, it's only, I've cut it down to like half an A4 page, the technique for doing it. The technique's called how to take adversity onto the path. In terms of conventional bodhicitta and ultimate bodhicitta, it's really simple and completely workable. From there, so you do that, become really familiar with it, then humans and non-humans are not going to be a problem to you.
And so by non-humans, is that things like natural disasters or the weather?
Yeah,
the
all those sort of things. Plus, they go to spirit home.
So that's like neuroses now, terminology.
Yeah. So, and here's this lovely thing. So I ask you, why have you gone for refuge? You could say, because I wish to accomplish everything. I'm aiming it. And lastly, another one is, you quickly achieve Buddhahood. So another time where Kinsa Rinpoche is talking about, when we use these Buddhist words, we should be able to turn them into English words. So they have more power for us. So if you ask us, what is the Buddha then? We should be able to answer that question using English that they understand. So you could say, for instance, well, there's something that's put an end to every form of suffering you can ever experience and have developed all their good qualities. That's what the Buddha is, someone who's done that. You see, I'd like to do that for myself. Seeing as a human being and taught the methods to do it, that's why I'm a Buddhist. And so, why would you want to do that to accomplish the welfare of others? Now, this is another way of describing Buddha. The person who's accomplished the two welfares, welfare of others, welfare of self. How did we do that? Well, they got rid of everything that hinders their spiritual progress and developed every good quality that a mind can. So, when they use the term uncreated, what they're talking about is the emptiness.
The Buddha nature, the emptiness. Or
just the emptiness. Just the emptiness itself. Because emptiness is not created. So, this last question is, how do you know you've gone for refuge?
Good question.
So this, so the answer to this is the measure of having gone for refuge answers the question of how do I know that I've got refuge? So the measure of actually having gone for refuge is to possess deep confidence in the objects of refuge. So that's what we study, to develop the confidence. Because if we don't have confidence in them, well, you don't have a refuge. It's the same way of thinking, like for me, like, oh, if I just had the wealth, I'd be happy. And then you have the wealth, and you have people come and rob you. Or like in communist China at one stage, you know, so they had this idea, like to be wealthy, possess objects and so forth, right? So you want to work very hard. So it's happened in Russia too. Right? So you work very hard to get yourself a farm, look after your family and so forth. And they did. Lo and behold, a new political movement takes place. And now you guys, your own stuff are seen as the enemy of the people. So they killed them all. So the desire for wealth and security as a way of refuge for you to be happier was actually a means to get you killed. So that's happened over and over. It says you think you can have a great deal of money and to be happy. So I always remember this scene in a film called The Serpent's Egg. This guy that came in to buy a drink in the bar had to wheel in a wheelbarrow of money. But because money doesn't have any value on its own. And in fact, what was more valuable was the meat of a dead horse out on the street. Because the meat could keep you alive, no matter how much money you could have, you could die of starvation. So those, once again, I'm just trying to point out, like, you could put these, you could have confidence in these other things, but you'd be mistaken. They're unstable.
Yeah, they're unstable things. And we do put our confidence in those other things, like savings, houses, or the stock market, and then we're continuously surprised when
it doesn't provide that safety.
It doesn't at all. So having confidence in ordinary refuge, that's a real foolhardy confidence, but we just, probably because of our attachment, we just think if I have enough confidence, if I just believe, it'll come to pass,
and
this is a different type of confidence.
Yeah, and so you can see, like, the confidence is internal, but an internal confidence, which is highly dependent on the development of our own mind, which is in harmony with the way things are, with the reality.
So this would mean we become free of fear.
Yeah, that's certain. That's how they describe the Buddha, someone who's free of fear. If you know how things actually exist and you are in harmony with them, why would you be fearful? Yeah, so we have this deep confidence in it. And as you know, and as the Buddha recommended, he says, so don't just take what I'm saying because I'm called Buddha. So investigate for yourself. Only when you're asserting yourself that what I've said is true, adopt it. I think it's a wonderful thing to say. So in brief, refuge is a state of mind. Just like that we usually say, it's a state of mind. And to discover that or reaffirm that, we've gone through these 12 questions and the 4 questions of the sample system. Have a look at this material, pages 1 to 7 of these refuge meditations. Take any one of them, do them a few times. Review any of the past material, because coming up on the 12th of December, which is only less than 2 weeks away, we have the refuge ceremony taking place here at 1:30 p.m. with Geshe Sultan from Chen Resnik Institute. Okay, so I think we've created some merit. So through the spirit, may all of our teachers, all students of the Dharma, our benefactors, our visitors and sentient beings have happiness. May they all be free from suffering. And may their sufferings, indifference, self-cherish, and ego-grasping ripen upon the mind that we have that is neglectful of others. Never separated from the happiness free of suffering, may every being abide in equanimity, the equality of all things. So dedicating just as the great Bodhisattva Samantabhadra and Manjushri did, may we who exist in mere name attain mere enlightenment, which exists like a dream. Indeed, all these dreamlike sentient beings exist in mere name to that enlightenment, which exists in name only, by ourselves alone, which, like dreams or illusions, exist in mere name. Okay. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.